As Parshat Re'eh opens, in the midst of Moshe's longest and most significant farewell address to the Israelites about to cross over into the land, he begins to speak in the premonitory language of a prophet, signaling to the people two alternate visions of their future. Re'eh, Anochi noten lifneichem hayom bracha uklala. See, I place before you today a blessing and a curse. Et habracha, the blessing, if you listen to the commandments of the Eternal your God, which I am commanding you today. Bahaklala, and the curse, if you do not listen to the commandments of the Eternal God and turn from the path that I have commanded you today, following after other gods that you do not know. The Parsha's lead word, re'eh, see, gives extra emphasis to Moshe's charge, alerting his audience to pay careful attention to what comes next. And the definite articles in the blessing and the curse then gesture toward particular outcomes. Yet it's never made entirely clear what these two possible futures entail. What will it look like for this new nation to achieve its blessing or to endure its curse? In Nevi'im Rishonim, the narrative books of the prophets, we find two later stories in Tanakh that each draw from language in the warnings here in Parshat Re'eh in order to suggest potential fulfillments of the blessing and the curse. The first of these callbacks makes use of a phrase that appears early on in our Parsha. As Moshe continues to encourage the people to heed the commandments when they enter the land, he offers them a point of contrast. Lo tasun kechol asher anachnu osim po hayom, ish kol hayashar be'inav. You shall not do as we do here today, where every man does what is right in his own eyes. Moshe seems to acknowledge that in the chaos of the desert journey, there's been some room for independent, informal decisions about how to live together. But he also insinuates that there have been some shortcomings in this system. Perhaps he means to attribute some of the conflict and violence of the journey to this loose organizational structure. Once they settle in the land, however, this will have to change. They will have to learn to order their society, establish the rule of law, and keep the forces of mayhem under control. Otherwise, they will all be in danger. But a sensitive reader of Tanakh may hear in this verse an ominous forecast of days to come. Because the phrase, every man does what is right in his eyes, comes up again, quite prominently, later in the Bible. It appears twice in the book of Judges, first in chapter 17, and then again, identically, in chapter 21, as the final line of the book. Bayamim hahem ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'inav yaseh. In those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. What lies between these two callback verses is perhaps the most horrifying scene in the entire Bible. The book of Judges describes a chaotic transitional period in ancient Israel, after the death of Yoshua, but before the people call for a king in Israel, in the book of Samuel. With no clear leadership structure, society begins to unravel. Tribal warfare eventually breaks out, and it's no longer safe to travel into strange territory. In this setting, a man from the tribe of Ephraim makes the mistake of wandering into a Benjaminite village and is quickly surrounded by a band of violent thugs. Every man in this scene does what is right in his own eyes, and they all behave monstrously. An innocent woman is caught in the midst of the conflict and assaulted in the most gruesome and despicable way, raped and mutilated. The horror of the story reaches unthinkable extremes when the woman's husband finds her dead and, as an expression of his rage and a bizarre form of rebuke, he cuts her into 12 parts and sends one to every tribe in Israel. The reaction is one of total shock. Vahaya kol haroe v'amar lo niyata v'lo nirata kazot miyom alot bnei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim ad hayom hazeh. Everyone who saw cried out, never has such a thing happened. Never has such a thing been seen from the day the Israelites came out of the land of Egypt to this day. After the earlier reference to Parshat Re'eh, there is an irony in the emphasis this verse places on seeing. All those who saw, kol haroeh, say emphatically that this has never been seen, lo nirata. But perhaps if they had heeded our parsha's call to see, re'eh, they would have been more wary of what can happen when there are no leaders, no laws, and every man does what is right in his own eyes. They might have known that a terrible curse was coming. The book of Judges makes a point of linking this cursed state of affairs to the lack of a monarch. Both of its callbacks to Parshat Re'eh are introduced by the phrase, "In those days there was no king in Israel." The chaos and violence that characterizes the period of the Judges leaves the people devastated, fed up with anarchy, and longing for a king. It is in the next period of ancient Israel, chronicled in the Book of Samuel, that the people will get their king. Fitting, then, that Samuel will borrow from another set of phrases in Parshat Re'eh to describe the most triumphant moment of kingship in Israel, in order to suggest that our people achieved some measure of the blessing of Re'eh as well. Let's take note first of the language from our Parsha. Immediately after Moshe tells the people not to do whatever is right in their own eyes when they come into the land, he gives them this charge. Va'avartem et ha'yarden, v'yishavtem ba'aretz, asher Hashem Elokeichem manchil etchem, v'heiniach lechem mikol oyveichem misaviv, v'yashavtem betach. When you cross the Jordan and settle in the land that the Eternal your God is allotting to you, and God grants you safety from all your enemies around you, and you live in security, then you must bring everything that I command you to the place where the Eternal your God will choose. Hamakom asher yivchar Hashem Elokeichem. Rashi's commentary, borrowing from the Sifrei in Devarim, draws connections from these verses to one that appears just after David ascended to kingship, defeated the Philistines, and brought back the Ark of the Covenant. Vahaya hamakom, the place where the Eternal your God will choose here in Deuteronomy, means build yourselves the temple, the chosen house in Jerusalem. That's why it says with David, and so it was when the king was settled in his house, and God had granted him safety from all his enemies, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See, I sit in a house of cedar, while the ark of God sits in a tent." The quote Rashi ends with describes King David's call to build a temple for God. Notice that the description of David's circumstances parallels exactly the language back in our Parsha, where the notion of establishing a chosen place of worship first arises. David was settled in his house and had been granted safety from his enemies. There are already striking linguistic echoes. But there is another word in that quote that makes the connection airtight. Re'eh, see. David starts his vision for building the temple with the very word that starts our Parsha. It is as if he has read Parshat Re'eh and is remembering how it goes. He sees suddenly that he is living it, and is perhaps now worthy of its blessing. So he calls out the word Re'eh, as if to say, "Look, see, this is the time for the ultimate blessing. I will be the one to build the temple." And yet, though David has all the right references in place and seems to have read all the right signs, God's response suggests that David has been a bit too presumptuous. Ha'ata tivne li bayit l'shifti? Are you the one to build a house for me to dwell in? God asks, almost incredulously. It is true, God says, I have made you a king and given you safety from all of your enemies, but you are not the one I choose for this blessing. Instead, God says that David's heir to the throne, Hu yivne bayit l'shmi, he will build a house in my name. Even at this moment of ultimate blessing, the greatest king of Israel at the height of his powers, seeking to use those powers to serve God, David is denied his aspirations for the complete fulfillment of prophetic blessings. The book of Samuel thus retains a note of ambivalence about the blessing of the monarchy. The prophet Shmuel himself, after all, was angry when the people first asked for a king, and he warned them that a king would conscript your sons and seize your daughters. Lo and behold, It's only several chapters after David dreams of building the temple that he uses his power as commander of the army to send a man to the front lines with the secret agenda of taking the man's wife after he falls in battle. When David's son, Shlomo, becomes king and eventually does build the temple, he takes these sorts of royal privileges to even greater extremes, forcing thousands into his service and marrying hundreds of women. And eventually, he falls into idol worship. A powerful king can prevent danger, but he can also become a danger of his own. These two stories, then, leave us with two lessons about how to read prophecy into history. On the one hand, it's wise to listen very carefully to the warnings from our prophetic tradition, especially when they speak of the curses that can befall us when we have no laws or leaders to guide us, when we allow our society to devolve into the savagery and chaos of everyone doing whatever is right in their own eyes. The horrors that follow may exceed all of our expectations. But on the other hand, we should also be careful not to overread the words of the prophets into history, a temptation we may feel especially during periods of great blessing. We see the fulfillment of long-awaited promises, and we assume that we have correctly identified the will of God at work in the world. The ultimate blessing must be imminent, we think. The time of our redemption is at hand, and it remains only for us to reach out and take a hold of it. Parshat Re'eh asks us, first and foremost, to see, to stay clear-eyed and attentive, neither to be blind to curses that may lie before us, nor to be blinded by the blessings that we have already achieved. Such warnings feel especially relevant at a moment in history when many of us are deeply suspicious of our leaders and their agendas, but also scared of the unspeakable violence that human beings are capable of when no one is in control. Moshe's repeated emphasis on following the path of the commandments of the Eternal your God is both an affirmation of the importance of law and order in human society, and a reminder that the only leader worthy of our devotion is no earthly king, but the one who rules above them all.